You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio on 88.1 or 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bear. House of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
I really believe what Paul Robeson said 50 years ago, which is that political movements succeed when people fight their own oppression. And my own oppression and the oppression of many rural people in my community and my own is that of being a self-employed person, which is the highest tax, most regulatory burden, least protected Americans. And we have a real problem out here, and it's a problem for the whole community, because in rural America and local urban economies, we're the backbone. And Republicans and Democrats don't know our name.
That was the voice of Mark Dunow, the Green Party candidate for the 24th Congressional District that encompasses parts of 11 counties in the Finger Lakes, Central and Northern New York, including the city of Geneva, Seneca, Cayuga, Cortland, and parts of Tompkins counties. Tonight on the program, we'll feature an extended interview with Mark Dunow. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary.
The home soon like lightning, we soon will be riding my shiny black.
On October 10th, the Congress of the United States demonstrated that whomever it does represent, it isn't us. In spite of millions of calls, letters, faxes, and emails running 100-1 in opposition to Bush's war, and anti-war demonstrations and resolutions in cities and towns from coast to coast, the House of Representatives voted 196-133 to authorize G.W. Bush to commit acts of war against Iraq in our names, with our bodies, and with our tax dollars. Later that evening, the Senate joined the House in supporting the measure by a vote of 77-33. Amo Houghton, representing voters in Seneca, Schuyler, Yates, and Corning counties, was the lone Republican voice in the New York congressional delegation to put the wishes of his constituents for peace over his party's line. Democrat Maurice Hinchey, representing Ithaca and parts of the Southern Tier, also voted against the Bush war and took a leading role in the pre-vote floor fight to vainly insist that Republicans divide the time between yeses and noes equally. Hinchey is running for re-election in the 26th District and clearly paid attention to anti-Iraq war resolutions passed by local governments in Ithaca and Danby last week. Both New York Senators Clinton and Schumer voted with the Bush gang. Like the congressional Democrats from the state, the majority of whom also voted with Bush, they've demonstrated once again the truth of the criticism that a choice between Democrats and Republicans is like a choice between Coke and Pepsi, two elaborately packaged corporate products containing a dark fizzy liquid that rots your teeth. Most Americans are so disgusted with both parties that they don't even bother to vote. Since elections are the basis of America's claim of being the world's greatest democracy, why can't the majority of people get real representation? Why can't new parties that could speak for our disaffected majority gain a foothold? Stephen Hill of the Nonprofit Center for Voting and Democracy and author of the new book, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, says the structure of the American electoral system itself is designed to make sure that nothing changes. He spoke with Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters.
You could give a brief bio of yourself and the Center for Voting and Democracy.
Okay. The Center for Voting and Democracy is a nonprofit educational research organization that specializes in voting systems and ways to empower voters to increase representation, participation, and better methods of governance. And we're 10 years old. John Anderson, who is a former presidential candidate and congressman, is the president of our organization.
And do you primarily just focus on voting here in the U.S.?
Yes, primarily we focus on voting in the U.S., but we do research into voting methods used in other countries, proportional representation, cumulative voting, single transferable vote, choice voting systems like this. We also do a lot of research into the redistricting process and the impact of voting systems on campaign finance reform and term limits and some of the other reforms that have been promoted over the last decade or so.
Your book has an interesting title, Fixing Elections. Tell us about that.
The title of my book is Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics. And the title, Fixing Elections, is deliberately provocative. There's kind of a double meaning there. One is fixing elections as in offering some solutions, which my book does do. But also it's fixing elections in the sense that our elections are rigged in a certain way. That when you look at, for instance, like the redistricting practices that we have, whereby the incumbents get to draw their own district lines, and in this most recent redistricting that just occurred, as many have been saying, it's the worst incumbent protection plans they've seen ever. You have states like California where, as one congresswoman said, all the incumbents paid $20,000 to the political consultant who was redrawing the district lines to draw them a safe seat, a seat that they could win in without really even running for re-election. As a result of that, out of 53 congressional seats in California, only one of them is competitive, is up for grabs. All the others are done deals. You know, the voters don't even have to show up in those elections because they've already been, the lines have been rigged to determine who's going to win, either Democrat or Republican. And then you look at, for instance, our presidential election that we had in November 2000, everybody knew that there was only about 8 or 9 states that were up for grabs. All the other states, plus the District of Columbia, were all done deals. They were safe states for one party, one candidate, or the other. And so when you think about all the money that's raised and that kind of thing in the presidential election, it was all being targeted at just these handful of states. And then not only that, but they don't even have to talk to all the voters in those handful of states. They know within each state that there's certain voters that they can take for granted and others that they're never going to have a chance of winning their vote. So if it's a Democratic candidate, they know, well, the Democratic voters are going to vote for me and the Republican candidates, they're not going to vote for me, so I don't have to worry about them. They target their message at a very small segment of voters within those states, you know, maybe 10 to 15% of voters who are undecided. And so what should be a national campaign in a presidential election really boils down to the most provincial of considerations are just a handful of voters and a handful of swing states that determine our presidential elections. And so in that sense, that's just two examples, and I go into many others in my book. In that sense, the elections really are rigged in a sense, in the sense that for many voters, they're witnessing these elections as if they're just bystanders on the sidelines because the candidates aren't talking to them. They aren't addressing their issues because most voters don't fit into this small category of swing voters who determine elections in our winner-take-all system.
In your book, you point out that our current winner-take-all system is the very same system that we started out with at the beginning of this country. Can you give us a sense of history of that and where things changed during that time period?
Sure. The winner-take-all voting system is what we've always used. It's in the book, it's what I call 18th century democracy technology. And in that sense, it's as outdated as something else from the 18th century might be, particularly in the current climate where they have really sophisticated technology for conducting politics today. So they use, for instance, in the redistricting process, very advanced computers and software and databases that allow them to really carve their districts up into a very personalized district for each incumbent. And so the technology has reached a point where, you know, we like to think that on the first Tuesday in November, we go to the voters' booth and pick our representatives, but in fact, the politicians are picking us, and they're doing that through the redistricting process with these highly sophisticated technologies and computers. And that's relatively new in this redistricting process. So there's always been a certain amount of gerrymandering that went on in our redistricting process and in our winner-take-all system. But the use of computers to really, really carve it up in such a precise way and really decide whose votes are going to count and whose are not, that's fairly new. The other thing that's new in terms of the technologies being used in the winner-take-all system have to do with the ways we campaign today. Today, because they can figure out exactly which districts are competitive and which are not, and they can figure out which states are competitive and which are not, that means they can use things like polling and focus groups and dial meter groups and 30-second TV spots to really precisely target their message to only a handful of voters in these swing states. And by doing this, all the other issues that other voters care about are left on the sidelines. So to give you an example, in the November 2000 presidential election, both sides had figured out that the swing voters in that election were basically seniors who were of better than average income and who lived in just a handful of states. And so the issues that they were talking about, we might recall, were issues like Social Security, prescription drugs, Medicare, all these sorts of things, ones that affected these seniors, who most of them who had higher than average income. So as a result of this, what should have been a national election boiled down to just these handful of voters being spoken to. And so voters like young voters, for instance, or Washington Post did a series on poor people in Pennsylvania, which was a swing state. So you'd think that their vote would matter. And in fact, those voters, even in a swing state, poor voters, their votes really didn't matter. The candidates didn't talk to them, didn't address their issues, and they felt left out of the political process. So when you're looking at things like voter turnout and participation, how we campaign today, and who the candidates choose to talk to by using these modern technologies like polling and focus groups and what have you, really is having a huge impact on whether voters feel engaged and feel like they have any connection to the politicians who are running for the office.
So it sounds like they kind of select specific groups, they incense and get a certain segment of the population irate enough to go to the polls, and then at the same time they're also ignoring or disempowering other people that could affect the vote as well, disempowering them enough to keep them away from the polls.
Exactly. So what that means is when it comes down to a two-party, two-candidate system, is that winning is what's called a zero-sum game. If I win, you lose. If I can drive voters away from you, the only choice left is me. So you use the polling and the focus groups to figure out which message are going to drive voters away from your opponent and which message will at least give them a warm, fuzzy feeling about you as a candidate. And so that becomes your political campaign. You're targeting the small slice of swing voters, and everyone else is sliced and diced out of the political process, and then you use negative campaigning and mudslinging to whatever extent that you can to drive the swing voters away from your opponent. And that basically describes our political campaign practices. And so, you know, a presidential election should be a time of when the nation is considering the great issues of our times and voters are most engaged, and instead it's becoming anything but. It's become essentially cotton candy for the, you know, handful of swing voters. And I should add that one political consultant described swing voters as those voters who are least engaged in politics, have the least interest or knowledge about it, and if you can't grab them in 8 seconds or less, you've lost them. So these are the voters that all the plays are made to, and these are the voters that essentially determine the winners in close races in our winner-take-all political system.
And as we saw in the last presidential election, the continuing phenomenal increase in the amount of money that's going into these, where is that money going? Is it going just to these political consultants and these companies that produce the software that does the redistricting?
Well, the techniques of campaigning today, we're using polling and focus groups and dial meter groups, are incredibly expensive, and it does require all these professionals and these sorts of things. To give you an example, when Bob Dole gave his 1996 acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, beneath the floor of the convention was a cavernous hall in which they had all these dial meter groups. And what a dial meter group is you bring into a room a bunch of people who are undecided voters, and you have them listen to a speech or watch a commercial, and they sit there with a dial. And if they like what they're hearing, they crank their dial all the way to the right in the high zones. And if they don't like what they're hearing, they crank it all the way to the left in the low zones. And by doing this, they amass this information. Not only do they have them below the floor of the convention, but they also had them hooked up in Atlanta and Detroit and a couple of other cities. And they were basically finding out which words and which concepts got a rise out of people and made them, you know, excited or turned off to what the candidate was saying. These kind of practices are being used all the time, and they're rather Orwellian, really, and when you think about it. I mean, they're basically, you know, using these techniques to figure out what words and what concepts will sell to you what they want to do. Because some have said, well, if they're doing these polling and focus groups, they really want to know what voters have to say, so maybe that means they're being more accountable. But two researchers have found, no, not at all. Instead, what they're doing is they are using these techniques to do what they called crafted talk and simulated responsiveness. They are finding out what words and concepts will allow them to do what they want to do and basically sell the voters a bill of goods, you know, and kind of like a used car salesperson would do. So these are the techniques that are going on in our winner-take-all system, and the winner-take-all system makes them much more effective because when there's only two candidates running in most races, as I said, you use these techniques to drive voters away from your opponent, which is much easier to do when you have a two-choice system like we have.
If we could stick with this redistricting for a little bit, basically, how is redistricting done? Who's making the choices on this? Why isn't there any citizen input on it?
The redistricting process in most states is a travesty of democracy. You have the incumbents and the party leaders who basically have just a couple of incentives. One is to guarantee their own reelection, and two is to guarantee the reelection of as many of their colleagues and try to win control of the legislatures. That's basically what's going on in redistricting, and the impact on voters is not taken into consideration at all. So they're not concerned about the fact that once this process is over, as we just saw, most seats at that point are safe seats and done deals, and voters have really no choice except to ratify the candidate of the party that dominates the district that has been drawn to produce that result. And this also has huge implications for campaign finance reform because, you know, a lot of times people say, well, money buys elections. But in fact, the impacts of redistricting trump the impacts of money hands down. Once you've drawn the district to make it so lopsided that only a Democrat can win this district or only a Republican can win this district over here, at that point, the role of money in those elections is really subsidiary. In fact, the donors at that point are giving money to the candidates they know are going to win because the district has been drawn to produce that result. So the donors at that point are buying access, not elections. It's a subtle difference, but it's an important difference that we really have to understand if we want to be able to truly reform our system. So these districts are being drawn in such a way as to basically make voters' votes not really count for much. When you show up to the voters' booth, it's already a done deal. The other aspect of it that's going on is that the party leaders are sort of sitting back like military generals looking at the political map. And they're able to say, okay, this district over here, we know we've got that one won. We don't have to spend any money. This other district over here, we don't have a chance over there. Let's not spend any money or any resources over there. Let's raise all this money and focus it like a laser on just these handful of districts. And so you have incumbents like, you know, where I live in San Francisco, Nancy Pelosi, who doesn't need to spend a dime to win re-election. She wins with 80% of the vote. She's a Democrat in a very liberal city. And yet she still raises millions of dollars. And so you say, well, what does she do with this money? Well, she takes this money and she gives it to colleagues in closer races. And by doing that, she buys their allegiance when it comes time to vote for a party caucus leadership. So she's now the House Minority Whip for the Democratic Party. And so by doing this, the real impact of our money is that it creates these kind of political machines. It's almost kind of a pyramidal shape to all our politics where these incumbents raise money that they don't need for their own re-elections. They give it to colleagues in close races. And by doing that, they buy themselves committee chairpersons, subcommittees, and what have you. They become the chairs of all these different committees and subcommittees. So that's really the fuller anecdote of what's going on in our political system and how it really is being distorted not only by money but also by the redistricting process, which is, of course, part and parcel of our winner-take-all political system.
That was Stephen Hill, author of Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, speaking with Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters. Voters of the newly redrawn 24th Congressional District will actually have a choice at the polls next month. The Democrats have not even bothered to run a candidate, as they no doubt believe the district has been gerrymandered to give the win to the Republican incumbent from the Utica area, Sherwood Bollert. Bollert is challenged by three candidates. Dr. David Waldrath, who ran against Bollert in the Republican primary on a platform that Bollert wasn't Republican enough and not sufficiently supportive of Bush. He's now on the ballot for the Conservative Party. Also running is Kathleen Peters on the Right to Life party ticket, which describes its political goal as recriminalizing abortions and preventing euthanasia. And then there's Mark Dunow, the Green Party candidate who has published a 16-point platform, which he calls 16 Green Declarations, that cover issues dealing with the economy, the environment, health, taxes, and civil liberties. Next, we'll present an extensive interview with Mr. Dunow, which we recorded earlier this week. Many voters don't have a clear idea of what the Green Party is, and this is in part because the Greens have become a convergence point for a variety of political tendencies standing in opposition to corporate rule that have nowhere else to go. The presidential candidacy of Ralph Nader has probably contributed to this lack of clarity. Nader, though he is a defender of the individual against corporate power and has a long history of fighting to clean up the environment, both green values, is really more of a traditional progressive than a green. Dunow's positions are classical green, exemplifying an approach to politics that reflects the increasing irrelevance of the traditional conceptions of left and right. Over the past several weeks, Dunow has been walking through the 11-county district carrying a flag with the slogan, "Don't Tread on Me." Like the New Yorkers who carried that flag in the American Revolution, Dunow is a family farmer, and he has placed issues relating to farmers and the self-employed at the forefront of his campaign.
And a lot of people are picking up on that message. And it's not just Greens that's picking up on it. I'm also voting delegate for the extremely conservative New York Farm Bureau, because I'm on the board of directors of the Delaware County Farm Bureau. But we share a lot of in common, which is one, that we're self-employed, and two, that we hate NAFTA and GATT. In the last 5 years, the official policy of New York Farm Bureau is now to take care of the self-employed as a primary issue, and we oppose NAFTA and GATT and Fast Tracks Authority and a whole number of things that progressives and the conservatives actually have in common. Of course, we have a lot in different, but I like to say that once we succeed at what we have in common, we could, you know, knock the crap out of each other then. But, you know, we share a hatred of NAFTA and GATT, and we should really be fighting that. And, you know, Sherwood Bollard, our incumbent, has voted for NAFTA and GATT and for Fast Track Authority and to increase the self-employment tax 50% and to have a missile defense shield, and the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which destroyed local TV and radio ownership, and could go on and on. So there's definitely differences between me and the incumbent.
Dunow's opponents, Waldrath and Bollard, are also presenting themselves as supporters of small business. Representative Bollard's website features the Congress member receiving an award as the, quote, "guardian of the small business" by the National Federation of Independent Business. Dunow thinks Bollard's portrayal of himself as a champion of small business is misleading, as the incumbent's record has hurt, not helped, people like Dunow.
Congressman Bollard is probably of the same frame of mind as the Small Business Administration, which doesn't consider even look at you unless you have 50 employees or more. Okay, so when I say the self-employed, I'm talking about the unincorporated businesses out here, those people that aren't incorporated, that have their businesses as self-employed people and pay the self-employment tax, which is a 15.3 flat tax of all on all your income below $84,000. So, yeah, his small business people are, you know, the 50, 100, 200, 500, you know, a small business in this country is 500 employees. You know, that's his small business. I'm talking about the carpenters, the bluestone workers, the machinists, the mechanics, the farmers. 90% of farmers in the United States are self-employed. That's who I'm talking about when I say self-employed. And, yeah, of course, there are small business people that relate to every single thing I say, and S corporations, which are a way of self-employed people to get a few of the benefits of corporations while being self-employed, S corporations can recognize that they are included in my self-employed description, but not in the description of, you know, companies with 100 and 200 people. So I'm not picking a fight with them, but I'm sure that's who Congressman Bollard is relating to and not the self-employed, because I've never heard the word self-employed out of his mouth, and it's certainly not on his website, and it's all over mine. We organic farmers are often thought of as the socialist environmental wackos, but let me tell you, the organic farmers in New York Farm Bureau, they're the group that doesn't take any money at all from the government for anything because we don't need it, and they're not even offering it to us. So I'm not coming from a government, quote-unquote, handout perspective. I'm doing just fine in the free market economy. I just don't see very much of it around. I see that the self-employed are getting squashed by a very distorted definition of the free market. I'll give you an example. When you go to Asia, I've been around the world and I've spent a lot of time in Asia, and you go to Asia and people love going to Asia because the markets, the streets are full of people selling things. That's capitalism. Streets are empty in the United States. The home of capitalism, they're empty because you can't hawk anything on the street without a license in the United States. You can't sell food without a, you know, unless it's these irradiated hot dogs. It's not a capitalist society in the sense that you can go out there and make a living in the street. Look at those pictures at the turn of the century in the Lower East Side where my father grew up. The streets are teeming with people selling things. That is capitalism. When the streets are empty, that is not capitalism. That is like corporate capitalism making regulations that keep the self-employed off the streets. In my opinion, unemployed people are in fact self-employed. Because we still come in this country from a definition that we have such a free market economy that if you don't have a job, you can get out in the street and make money. But in fact, you can't get out in the street and make money. Literally, you can't get out in the street and make money because you'll get arrested for selling in the wrong place at the wrong time.
The first point of Dunow's platform is the statement, the federal government should not be of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations. We asked him to elaborate.
For example, we have something called the National Labor Relations Act, which is supposed to guide the relationship between organized labor and corporate power. Makes it a crime to fire someone for union organizing. That's the crime in the United States. But corporations have discovered that it's just cheaper to break the law and fire people and then pay a fine if that person has got enough fortitude to spend several years in court with the National Labor Relations Board to have his case reviewed, because there's no punitive penalty. If you win, you get your back wages. There's no teeth to that law. Consequently, Walmart is now the largest private employer in the United States of America, and yet it hasn't had a single union job because it's cheaper to break the law than it is to obey the law. And we do not have a Congress that has put teeth back into the National Labor Relations Act, by which I mean, you know, punitive penalties for wrongdoers with a long history, and also tripling, you know, not just equal to the employee's share, tripling the employee's wages if they're caught. You know, put teeth in it. We had a president talking about corporate accounting. That's what the crisis was, corporate accounting. It's corporate accountability, and we're supposed to break down on people that screw up their books. Well, yeah, investors are unhappy about people that screw up their books, but laborers have to be equally unhappy about corporations that break the law. And so that's an example, I believe, of the government by the corporations and for the corporations.
Dunow talked about his opposition to Bush's war plans against Iraq, and the conversations he's been having with the people he's encountered on the campaign trail and in his community.
Myself and Kathleen Peters, who is the Right to Life candidate, both oppose this war. And I oppose it because, though I do believe Saddam Hussein is a dangerous human being, I don't think we're going to gain anything by attacking Iraq at this time. We took a really strong stance that has gotten us the weapons inspectors have been invited back into Iraq. I think the sooner they get back in there, the better. If they report there's a real danger, then we should stomp and snort and make sure that we see everything. But the idea that we're going, you know, this war fever that is taking over this country is outrageous. And it's happening right now. In my opinion, it came out of Karl Rove's mind, who is the chief advisor to the president. Because this was not, they did not want this to be an election based on the economy, which is tanking, despite the fact for the last year they've been saying it's really recovering, it's going to get better, it's right around the corner. It's tanking big time. And as soon as the deficits that they're running force interest rates up, the housing will stop. The cars are going to stop being bought, which is why the economy is just stumbling. It's only stumbling right now. When the cars and the houses stop being built because the interest rates go up, then we're really in trouble. And so this election to me is about, this war fever is about putting our view at Saddam Hussein and not our vision at the economy and the corporate corruption that is endemic to the Bush administration, from Cheney, who's been caught with, you know, his corporate wrongdoing, and Mr. Bush looking like he was doing some hanky-panky in the whole administration. So my opinion is that it's a distraction. And for the last 25 years, the corporate elite, the power elite of this country has been fabulous about distracting the American people from the issue. This is really sick, that we're threatening war so that so that the Republicans can maintain power in Congress is to me, it's just an incredible measure of how insidious that administration really is. And let me say, lastly, concerning war in Iraq, there is nothing that indicates that Saddam Hussein is more dangerous now than he was 11 years ago. He's much less powerful. 250,000 people, children, according to the UN, have died because of the sanctions, because this man has not been able to take the money and place it in such a way as to even fix the sewage the water treatment plants in his in Iraq, which is why so many people have been dying. I mean, the places, the water is filthy, people die. I don't see that this is the largest than it was 11 years ago. I mean, why is it now, just before the election? They haven't shown us one piece of evidence. Does it get any clearer? It can't get any clearer. The American people are now the most propagandized people in the history of the planet. It is so obvious that they don't want to face what's going on in the United States, because that has been terrible policy that will cost them the election. The people that I talk to, and it's not just the people that I talk to in the 24th Congressional District, it's my neighbors. I mean, they don't understand they don't want this country to go into Iraq. They don't want people to go, they don't want us to go into Iraq. I think they approve of weapons inspectors, as I approve of weapons inspectors. They don't see the necessity to bomb this nation and to commit our ground forces. One lesson from 9/11 is that I've taken out of it personally, and people share this when I give this as an image, is that people that live in glass houses shouldn't be throwing stones. And the American economy right now is a glass house. You know, that tragedy of 9/11 has just really made the airline industry an economic disaster area. There are our oldest airlines are going bankrupt because of one 4-hour period. And I believe that, you know, if we want to start this mess with Iraq, we are going to create more terrorists and more problems, you know. And I do support a war with Al-Qaeda, not a war on terrorism, quote unquote, because war is terror. So saying war on terror is like saying having a war on war, which I think is preposterous. Al-Qaeda hit us. We should focus on making sure that Al-Qaeda does not hit us again. That, to me, is just logical, and that's what people are telling you. They don't want to confuse a war with Iraq with a war on terrorism, and they are very, very different. I wasn't one Iraqi on that plane. It was 15 Saudis and 4 of other descents. There were no Iraqis on that plane. There were no Afghanis on that plane. We have a very, very complicated war with a very, very vicious enemy called Al-Qaeda, and war with Iraq is going to help Al-Qaeda, not hurt Al-Qaeda.
We asked Mark Dunow what he meant by a war with Al-Qaeda, and to address the actions taken domestically by the Bush government and Congress in the name of security in the wake of the 9/11 attack.
Well, I think that clearly there was an organization called Al-Qaeda that did put together the 9/11 incident, as it did put together the attack of our ship, I think it was called the York, off of Yemen, and there's no reason to believe that they've decided to stop. Consequently, I think that we have to find out who these people are and guard ourselves from being attacked again. And that's you know, my what I mean by a war with Al-Qaeda, because that group attacked us in an outrageous way where 3,000 Americans died. So let's focus on the group that did attack us. And the closest I can get to calling, naming that group is Al-Qaeda. The more things change, the more they stay the same. This question of security versus liberty has been with us since the Constitution was written and before. In fact, the Bill of Rights is a reaction to people having their individual liberties stomped on by the British for British security. My own feelings about homeland security are best summed up by what Benjamin Franklin said almost 250 years ago, which is that those that would sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither security or liberty. And so I do not approve of measures taken to undermine our civil liberties in this war on Al-Qaeda. But it's not called a war on Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is called a war on terrorism. And this is a terrible name, because what it's really becoming is that anybody that our friend, we will look the other way to if they oppress their people, as long as they don't mess with us. And this man in Pakistan, whose name I can't pronounce right now, he's a military dictator who was supporting the Taliban. He's now supporting us. He's thrown the Constitution out the window, and he's our best friend. And you know, Saudi Arabia, which is just a horrendous monarchy, which was the best friend of the Taliban and who gave tremendous amounts of money to Al-Qaeda and probably still does, you know, they're our best friend. You know, it doesn't matter to me. The terrible thing about calling a war on terrorism is that it seems that as long, if you wear the uniform of a nation now, it's all right to kill your own people, just as long as you keep the people that you're oppressing from hurting Americans. And that is insane. Tajikistan, which is now our good pal because of logistical support in Afghanistan, their ruler is so nuts that he just named the days of the week, he just officially changed the days of the week and the months of the year to names after people in his own family. And that's how the papers are written. That's our ally. That's not about liberty. That's just, and so I hate the way this war on terror is being, I hate calling it a war on terror. That's why I won't do it. I call it a war on Al-Qaeda. I support that. Everything else is creepy. Under this war on terrorism, you know, the French Resistance would have been terrorists. And of course, the French Resistance wasn't terrorists. They were fighting the Nazis. Terrorism is a strategy. You can't declare war on a strategy. Every single different group has used that strategy for different reasons. A war on a strategy, it doesn't work. It's not possible. I think the most important thing we have to do is protect our own sovereignty, by which I mean we will never have a secure world in the United States. We'll never be secure until our economy stops being based on Middle East oil. That's the bottom line. As long as our economy is based on Middle East oil, as long as we have to have a hose running, you know, several thousand miles across the world into our gas tanks, we have no hope of getting out of this war on terror. We are completely exposed. It's a huge vulnerability. And so I believe what I wish was we had a president that said, fellow Americans, the way that we're going to take care of ourselves and reduce the risk to human beings, to our own citizens, is by declaring that we are going to become energy self-sufficient insofar as we will not be taking oil from the Middle East anymore. And the way to do that is to push for wind energy and solar energy, so that, because these are the energies that create electricity. And if you create an abundance of electricity, I don't mean just to meet current demand. If you double how much electricity we produce in this nation through alternative energies, then you can make hydrogen power and hydrogen fuel cells work and get off of oil and gas. And that strategy would create more jobs and more wealth in this country than we've ever had before. And it would be a unique partnership between government and corporations and the self-employed, because all three would have to work together to wire this country and put up the units to take it. And, you know, if in terms of wind power, it takes $1.25 trillion to equal our current energy output. If we put up the wind turbines that are right now working in Madison County, the 7 wind turbines, and multiply their cost times 300,000, that would be $1.2 trillion, which would equal our entire energy output, and it's about $1.25 trillion to solarize the roofs of America. And then we've tripled our energy our electric output, which means that we can make hydrogen cheap and hydrogen is fuel cells. So that's the kind of economic policy, presidential action that I believe would actually make for security in this nation and a wealthy country that we'd all, it would turn a lot of cynics into citizens. Boy, you know, I think one problem we have in this country is that so many of us are cynical right now. And as a model for turning our energy needs around, I look right to the Rural Electrification Administration that electrified the United States in the 30s because private power companies refused to do it. They said there's no profit to be made. We're not going to be doing it. Not going to do it. 90% of rural America was 90% of farms when Roosevelt came in had no electricity. And so Roosevelt said, to hell with you corporations. I'm going to capitalize it myself. And so rural electric co-ops across the entire nation were started with federal money, federal loans, every dollar of which was paid back. And in 10 years, rural America was electrified with the capital of the United States that was paid back to the Treasury. It didn't even cost the people anything. That's the kind of program I think we need.
Another of Dunow's platform points calls for the federal government to step in when private markets have failed to meet the needs of the American people, as exemplified by the issue of affordable and renewable energy.
Right. That's my first example. Another example I give in that is healthcare, which, you know, believe me, I am not very enthusiastic about the government taking care of me, my healthcare needs. However, the insurance industry has done such a horrendous job that I don't know what other choice we have, because the private markets have clearly failed to meet the needs of the American people. 46 million people are uninsured. A huge percentage of those people are self-employed because we don't have the economies of scale to buy health insurance cheaply, like, or at a better price than some corporations that are bringing in hundreds of thousands of people under the same policy. At the same time, I do have health insurance. I have lousy health insurance, but I'm one of the lucky insured Americans. I'm not being served either. Americans are becoming really a sad reflection of our life is that many hardworking people now are indentured servants to their jobs because they can't quit because they'll lose their health insurance and they can't jeopardize themselves or their family. That's outrageous. So I think that we need to move into universal health care on the Medicare model, but with the stipulation that alternative therapies like chiropractor and acupuncture would be included. The private industry has completely failed the American people, and it's just time to stop this madness.
Several of Dunow's 16 points deal with environmental contaminants and health. He calls for the removal from the market of irradiated food, labeling and safety testing of genetically engineered food products, and the prohibition of sewage sludge on farmland. He has called for a Chemical Sovereignty Act, which would ban the importation of crops grown with chemicals prohibited in the United States. Dunow's platform contains a number of points related to the economy and finances, as well as address the future of Social Security.
Tons of food is imported into the United States every day that is produced with chemicals banned in the USA. And when I brought this point up to Maurice Hinchey when I ran against him in Congress in 1998 as a write-in candidate, he thought that is a problem, and this Mark Dunow has come up with the idea of a Chemical Sovereignty Act that would ban the import of food grown with chemicals banned in the USA. So I'm going to jump on that, and I'm going to introduce that when I go to the next session of Congress. And that bill was written up, and it was put in something called Legislative Council, which is bipartisan to make sure you dot the I's, cross the T's, so that when it gets a bill number, put it in the slot. There isn't obvious flaws. Well, as it happens, it's been in legislative council now for 4 years because under NAFTA and GATT, it's totally illegal to have a bill that would prohibit the import of food grown with chemicals banned in the USA. Now, I don't know a conservative or a progressive that thinks that that food belongs in our food system at all. If our scientists and our politicians get together and say this chemical does not belong in the food chain, then I don't know a single citizen that thinks, well, it really should be, it's okay if it comes from another country. And yet, we have signed treaties that make that act illegal. So it's one of the reasons I believe we have to get out of NAFTA and GATT. And, you know, and that does not mean that I'm against international trade, but I'm firmly against international trade that undermine our sovereign environmental protections, like having, you know, control of the chemistry. So that's an example. And I also say that, you know, the Greens completely endorse that idea, as does the conservative New York Farm Bureau. When I introduced that idea that we would support a bill that would prohibit the import of food grown with chemicals banned in the USA, that's been unanimous for the last 4 years. That's part of official New York Farm Bureau policy. Of course that should be the law of the land, and it's not the law of the land. It's far from the law of the land. It's another example of a government of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations, because many of those pesticides that are imported, that are banned in the USA, that are come in on import, were actually produced in the USA, because while it's illegal to use them in the USA, these pesticides, it's not illegal to produce them. So we export several tons a day of these banned pesticides and they come back on us. That's called the circle of poison. Irradiated food. Now, I changed my platform because I was just wanted to, you know, right now the label is getting smaller and smaller and smaller on irradiated food, and I think in the not-too-distant future it'll be eliminated. So my position just used to be keep the label big, that big radiation symbol on it, because people don't tend to buy food that they know is irradiated because it'll die in the marketplace. I don't think there should be a law banning everything. I hate that idea. But I think in many ways there are way too many laws in this country, okay? And I don't want to, every time I like something, I don't want to say law, ban, ban, ban. So I just wanted to have a law originally that labeled it. Unfortunately, since 9/11, they've had in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, they had a big day devoted to trying to come to grips with the irradiation food centers that are in the United States and around the world, because they're big factory complexes where they irradiate the food. And they irradiate the food either with cobalt-60 or cesium-137, and most of them apparently now are cobalt-60. I hope I'm getting my numbers right. Anyway, and they were asked, the industrial experts and the academicians were asked by the senators, what is the danger of a terrorist getting a hold of one of these bars of cobalt-60 and using it for terrorist purposes? And they said, A, it was very unlikely they'd get a hold of them because they were so well protected. B, if they got a hold of one, that it would kill them pretty quickly unless they were carrying it in some bizarre lead contraption that they couldn't think of. But then the senators pushed and they said, but if they got one of these bars, what would happen? And they could, like, control it. Then they said, if they got one of these bars, because, and there are now thousands of these bars, 40 irradiation food centers in the United States, 160 around the world, they got one of these bars and detonated it with conventional explosives, it would be a dirty bomb that would make Manhattan uninhabitable for decades. Now, that to me is madness, because the only reason we are irradiating food is because the Meatpackers Union has been broken. And the worst job in the country is being employed by mostly alien labor, which are these meatpacking factories in many in the Midwest, which are absolutely filthy. And by filthy, I mean literally the shit gets on the food. That's how you get sick from tainted food. Irradiation is about killing food that has been contaminated by shit. All right? There's nothing that irradiation does that can't be done with sanitary facilities like we used to have in this country. So I am now into banning irradiation because of the terrorist threat and the fact that the only reason we need it is that the working conditions are so bad and the meat processing facilities are so filthy. And it's actually another example of the law of unintended consequences. We had a great act called the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. Well, this sewage sludge comes from the Clean Water Act. Because to clean up America's waters, we had to stop discharging our municipal sewage into our rivers. And to do that, we had to create sewage treatment plants. And so when that sewage is taken care of properly and the water, dirty water goes in and comes out as clean water, you get a result, a product called sewage sludge, which for the first 10 years or so of the Clean Water Act, sewage sludge was hauled, most of it was hauled out into the oceans and dumped. Then in the late 80s, it started like flowing back. I don't know if you remember this, but it started flowing back in a lot of cities in the, on the eastern coast in particular, and people got horrified. And Congress acted really quickly to stop, to create the no No Ocean Dumping Act, or anyway, to prohibit sewage sludge from being dumped in the ocean. And so then there had to be a place to put the sewage sludge. So that when the Congress, so what the EPA did was they changed the standards for sewage sludge. So what was considered toxic and was being dumped in the ocean overnight, not by any change in the way it was treated, but by changing EPA regulations, sewage sludge became fertilizer. Now half the sewage sludge generated in the United States of America is being put on our farmland. And to give you a degree of how bad this is you can put on farmland, and this 267 pounds of lead per acre, and 17 pounds of mercury, and I think it's 36 pounds of arsenic. It goes on and on and on. We have the worst, we have the lowest standards for sewage sludge in the entire industrialized world. We have no standards for, there's nothing being measured to prevent any form of chemical. Anything that's in the sewage sludge that's a chemical is not being measured. It can be thrown on our farmland and is. And only thing that's protected are about 10 heavy metals, which I've already mentioned, lead, arsenic, and mercury, and seven others. There's guidelines to how much. But let me tell you, when you can throw 267 pounds of lead per acre under the EPA, you have a problem. And it's not just me that believes that we have a problem. It's Cornell, which is not known to be radical. But Cornell Waste Management Institute has been crazed about how bad this situation is for many years now. They've written a great book called The Case for Caution. And to give you an example, while we allow 36 pounds of arsenic on our farmland, they recommend, under these standards, they recommend less than 2. And it's the same with cadmium. It's just it's way too much. And they would also like standards for chemistry. The last thing I'll say about this subject is, so people can really envision it, if you took the sludge being generated in New York City, Pittsburgh, Binghamton, Montgomery, Alabama, New Orleans, Austin, Dallas, okay, just imagine the waste, because the bottom line problem is industrial waste and human waste are all mixed together in the same factory. This is the problem. It's not the human waste. It's the industrial waste and the human waste all are go together in the same waste stream. And out of it comes the sewage sludge. So imagine all those industrial toilets flushing and then spreading out on your farmland. That is the crisis. And, you know, I really think that we are of the soil, and to the soil we will return, literally. And so really we need to protect it, and we need to ban having sewage sludge thrown on our farmland.
What would you suggest be done with this sewage sludge?
Everything is in a phase. The first one is, it doesn't go on the farmland. I guess immediately we have to put it in landfills, which we contain. Contained landfills would be the short-term answer, because this won't. I want to prohibit it overnight. Actually, what I'd like to do is I'd like to take Cornell's recommendations, which are much better, and for the first 10, you know, because they reduce everything by about 10%. To 10% of what EPA says is okay. So if EPA gives the number 40, they reduce it to 4. Roughly, that's what they've been doing. Take Cornell standards and apply them immediately, because Cornell says it would take very little upgrades in the sewage treatment plant to make it to go to that standard. And then take the next phase would be, you still have sewage sludge, put it in a landfill. The final stage would be, you separate your industrial waste streams from your human waste stream. That's the key. And I do not know why, as citizens, we are subsidizing industrial factories. I know why we are, because every time the first question a corporation asks before they move into, when they move into a municipality, is, are you going to let us discharge into your waste stream? And the answer is yes, because you're not going to get the jobs or the factory if you don't. So it's another sub, it's the taxpayers are subsidizing with their money and their health the corporations from taking care of their own waste they generate. Another example of other corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations. I really do believe that genetic engineered food is one of those things that if it's labeled, it'll die in the marketplace. That's why I go for prominent labeling. I don't believe people will buy it if it's prominently labeled. Now, sadly, over 60% of our food has a genetic ingredient in it right now, most of which is in the form of genetically engineered soy and genetically engineered corn, and they're not even they're engineered insofar as they're Roundup ready, which means that there's an herbicide that you can spread on the fields that will not kill this type of soybean or corn. It'll grow just fine, and all the other everything else will die, and it's got to be called, it's genetically engineered, because a normal soybean and a normal corn would die with everything else. That's why it's called Roundup Ready. But I believe if you label food that has a genetically engineered product in it, it'll die in the marketplace. And if it doesn't die in the marketplace, then at least people know what they're eating. I think we have to have food safety testing, and the way I put that is, to me, it's absolutely clear that genetically engineered food should be treated as a food additive. These genes are added into the genetic structure of the cell. It's a food additive. We have really strict laws in this country and protocols that the FDA requires of testing, mandatory testing for food safety for when you come up with a food additive. Well, this is not genetically engineered food is not being tested as if it was a food additive. It's being treated as having equivalency. In other words, genetically engineered corn is just another variety of corn. And you don't test new varieties of corn for food safety, so you don't test genetically engineered food. That is how FDA has gotten in cahoots with corporations to get around the strong food additive laws we had.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio on 88.1. You're listening to an interview with Mark Dunow, Green Party congressional candidate for the 24th Congressional District. This is Unwelcome Guests.